Now
on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday Morning Update.
It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler, Jeff Wolf behind the console, Jane Houghton, our producer this morning. And we're going to cover some of the stories a little more in depth than the mainstream media has been covering them. As an example, one that strikes all of us is the wonderful performance of the stock market under the Biden administration and the economic advisors, the brilliance we've seen in being the stewards of our economy. Interesting notes, if you took a look at 2021, the year high for the stock market was 36,488. That's pretty good. At the end of the day yesterday, the stock market had dipped under 30,000 at one point. It was down like 1,300 points, but it ended up at the end of the day down nearly 500 points. That's below 30,000, the first time we've ended up below 30,000 since November of 2020. So we got a mess on our hands with the stock market, and that's our retirement, that's our investments, that's our 401ks. And that's hitting all of us, and the administration doesn't seem to be able to do anything about it. Added, 75 base points again onto the interest rates this week? 0.75 points? What does that do to your mortgage? What does that do to your auto loans, your credit cards? That's going to whack us. Oh, don't forget about inflation. Nice work, folks. But not hearing too much about that in the mainstream media, something they'd rather not talk about. What they want to talk about is Donald Trump and the case that the New York Attorney General has brought against Donald Trump. Now, the first thing that a lot of people don't seem to understand, and especially the people in Hollywood, all the celebrities that chimed in and were so ecstatic about Letitia James bringing a civil suit against Donald Trump. Key word is civil. It's not criminal. She spent 3 years on the investigation and couldn't come up with criminal charges, so she has to go and charge as a civil case. Well, here's how she explains it.
Donald Trump Jr., Ivanka Trump, and Eric Trump, and former Trump Organization CFO Alan Weisselberg and Trump Organization Controller Jeffrey McConney. Mr. Trump and the Trump Organization repeatedly and persistently manipulated the value of assets to induce banks to lend money to the Trump Organization on more favorable terms than would otherwise have been available to the company.
The loans were paid back. In typically, and I've talked to a couple of legal experts about this, and I'm not a lawyer, but I will paraphrase what I understand the situation to be. Typically, you bring a civil case or criminal charges in this type of situation where if somebody inflates maybe values of properties or inflates their salary to get a loan, typically the only time anybody does anything about it is if that person defaults on the loan. Trump did not default on the loans. There's no victim. It's a victimless crime. Now, we're up over, 2,000 murders in New York over the past 2 years in the state of New York. Thousands of robberies, people getting hit in the head for no reason in New York City. Assaults, burglaries, going crazy, smash and grabs. Why isn't the New York Attorney General paying a little more attention to those crimes versus Donald Trump? But she has been fixated on it. It was a campaign promise she made that she was going to get him. No politics there, no, not at all. Well, Bill Barr, the former Attorney General, who has been pretty straightforward in his feelings about the former president, chimed in about the lawsuit.
It's hard for me not to conclude it's a political hit job. I mean, this is a woman who campaigned for office saying that, promising she was going to go after Trump, which I think is a tremendous abuse of office to go headhunting and targeting individuals. So I think she was targeting Trump. And this is after 3 years, a civil lawsuit, the gist of which is that when the Trump Organization borrowed money, Trump personally guaranteed those loans. And to support that, she's claiming that he inflated his assets on his financial statements. Now, I'm not even sure she has a good case against Trump himself, but what ultimately persuades me that this is a political hit job is she grossly overreaches when she tries to drag the children into this. Yes, they had roles in the business, but this was his personal financial statement. It was prepared by the CFO. Accounting firms were involved in it. The children aren't going to know the details of that and be able, and nor are they expected in the real world to do their own due diligence and have it, you know, reviewed independently. And so this to me looks like gross overreach, which I think is going to end up backfiring on them, because I think it will make people sympathetic for Trump, that this is another example of people piling on because of Trump derangement syndrome, this, you know, this strong desire to, you know, to punish him.
So that's fairly mature, balanced assessment by the former attorney general. In contrast, here's another clip from Letitia James, the New York attorney general.
This investigation revealed that Donald Trump engaged in years of illegal conduct to inflate his net worth, to achieve, to deceive banks and the people of the great state of New York, claiming you have money that you do not have does not amount to the art of the deal. It's the art of the steal.
Oh, you are so cute. That's just so intelligent. It just boggles my mind the resources that were wasted on this case. And anything to get Trump. No victim, no default. And I'm not sticking up for him. I'm just saying it's crazy, and the Attorney General, former Attorney General Bill Barr, I think laid it out succinctly and maturely and intelligently versus the New York Attorney General. It is 6:17. It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL, and we head over to the WMAL Traffic Center. Angela Foster in this morning.
No delays as you pass the Beltway accident. Now move to the right shoulder in McLean. All lanes open on the inner loop at the George Washington Parkway, exit 43. No early distractions on 66, but we are starting to see some westbound slowing between the Capitol Beltway and US 50. A work zone is scheduled to begin on the eastbound side. We'll keep you up to speed if we have lane closures. Construction on Rockville Pike, and it is a bit slower than usual, traveling into Bethesda. Caution as you maneuver southbound between the Capitol Beltway and Pooks Hill Road. Traffic is getting by in two left lanes. It's a construction zone. It's also the merge from the inner loop to southbound Rockville Pike. Going to be a bit difficult with this work zone, so caution in that vicinity, but otherwise moving nicely in Rockville on I-270. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
A brisk start to the first weekend of fall. Temperatures will be climbing into the low and middle 70s this afternoon. A little bit less wind than we had yesterday under a good deal of sunshine. Overnight back in the 50s, some 40s in the cooler burbs. As we head through your Sunday, some added clouds in our next frontal system. Temperatures near 80 and maybe a shower, even an isolated rumble of thunder. By Monday, back to partly sunny skies and temperatures once again in the mid and upper 70s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Brian Vandegraaff in the First Alert Weather Center.
It is 50 degrees in the nation's capital. 6:19, the Saturday morning update on WMAL.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
The Saturday morning update continues. I'm Rick Fowler, and the big news for the Republicans at the end of the week, the announcement of the Commitment to America. The Republicans plan to halt Joe Biden's agenda, also to slow inflation and to reduce crime. The House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy introducing it yesterday, and this is how he summed it up in a preview.
What we wanted to do, a plan for a new direction. We want to be upfront with the American public. We want an election to have a contrast. If they put their trust in us, this is exactly what we'll do. Hold our feet to the fire. And on the very first day, we're going to repeal 87,000 IRS agents. So they're not going after you. We work for you. You don't work for us.
So that is Kevin McCarthy. They had a little Q&A scenario down there when they did the announcement in Monongahela, Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, of course, one of the hotly contested states coming up in the midterms for the Senate race. The Republicans vowing to rein in government spending to lower the worst inflation in 41 years. Consumer prices up 8.3% over 12 months as of August. The speaker is also promising to address crime, including the record-high illegal immigration. And now we're going to get to Marco Rubio's comments about a lawsuit in just a moment, but that's involving the immigrants that came in this week. But on the Republican issue, they're going to address rising violent crime in the cities, also fentanyl smuggling that is accelerating the overdose deaths. So that's the word from the Republicans. This echoes, of course, the Republicans' contract with America back in the Newt Gingrich days, back in the 90s. And we'll talk a lot more about that with John Gizzi this morning. So we'll get in some detail on what the Republicans have in mind coming up. Now, we're talking about immigration and the illegal immigration, and we saw the Ron DeSantis flight to Martha's Vineyard, where he sent migrants from Texas straight to Martha's Vineyard. It created a media firestorm, and all the progressives came out. The folks on Martha's Vineyard, the sanctuary city, shipped them off to Cape Cod as quickly as they could because they couldn't handle 50 people at Martha's Vineyard. How much wealth is there on Martha's Vineyard that they couldn't take care of 50 people for a few days instead of getting them on the first trip over to Cape Cod? But there's a lawsuit now has been filed on behalf of the immigrants against Ron DeSantis. Progressive lawyers got out there and figured, let's file a suit against DeSantis. Why not? Well, here's how Senator Marco Rubio of Florida responded to that.
Well, think about this, okay? People came into this country illegally, violating our laws, okay? And the first thing they do is get lawyers and use our laws to sue an elected governor, to sue a state. I mean, just think about that. They just got here. They're not even here legally. They didn't enter the country the proper way. And they're immediately in court demanding rights and claims under our laws. This is outrageous. What other country in the world would that even be allowed? What other country in the world would even tolerate that? So I think this is, you know, we have a, this is not immigration, what we're seeing, okay? This is mass migration. That's a very different thing. But to think about the fact that somebody just came here illegally, and within a week they're in court and they have lawyers representing them in court, suing the American government that whose laws they just violated, is unbelievable. It's outrageous. It angers me, and it should anger everybody.
Well, Senator Rubio sure nailed that one. Now, the attention that has been brought to the border crisis, a little more attention in the mainstream media, and, of course, a little more contention from the White House on that topic. The Democrats have been in office now for, a year and three quarters? You have a Democratic House, you have a Democratic Senate, and you have a Democratic White House, an executive branch. So you'd think, maybe in the last almost 2 years, since we have a border czar, Vice President Harris, you'd think maybe somebody would have done something about it. But you see, it's all Donald Trump's fault, according to the White House press secretary, Corinne Overhead Jean-Pierre.
It is a broken system, the immigration system. And it was decimated by the last administration. That is a fact. It was decimated by the last administration. What the last administration wanted was a border wall that was ineffective and used a use of taxpayers' dollars. And that's what we saw from the last administration.
It's all their fault. It's all the administration's fault from Donald Trump's administration, not our administration. We've had 2 years to do something about it, but it's all Trump's fault. Can you believe this? I mean, you talk about misrepresentation, misinformation, and flat-out lies. You got it right there. Interesting story in the Washington Post. This is fascinating. Now, you've seen the administration's focus on electric vehicles, green energy. Washington Post article yesterday. It's not an opinion piece, apparently. It's an article in the Post. Headline, it's common to charge electric vehicles at night. That will be a problem. Huh. As electric vehicles hit the road around the country, hundreds of thousands of Americans are beginning to learn the ins and outs of car charging. According to a new study from researchers at Stanford University, if electric vehicle sales grow rapidly over the next decade, and most drivers continue to charge their cars at home, vehicle charging could strain the electricity grid in western states, increasing net demand at peak times by 25%. That could be a problem as the West struggles to keep the lights on amid heat waves and rising electricity demand. The first thing to know about EV charging is that it's nothing like filling a car with gasoline. Charging an electric vehicle takes time. While the fastest chargers can charge an EV battery by 80% in 20 to 30 minutes, most chargers are slower, taking somewhere between 2 hours and 22 hours to get a full charge. This is an article in the Washington Post. I would suggest you grab it and print it, and then next time you have folks over and they start getting into an argument with you about maybe we're getting ahead of our skis on electric vehicles, whip that article out from the Washington Post, and you got some good ammunition there. It is 6:26. It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. John Gizzi will join us later on this morning. We've got Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, Cheryl Atkinson, Jim Trustee, Jennifer Harper, and, of course, KT McFarland all on the way. In the news at 6:30, Russian forces have launched new strikes on Ukrainian cities as Kremlin-orchestrated votes continue in occupied regions of Ukraine to pave the way for their annexation by Moscow. Half of Puerto Rico is without power more than 5 days after Hurricane Fiona struck the U.S. territory. Includes an entire town where not a single work crew has even arrived. Many people are angry and incredulous. Calls are growing to oust the island's private electricity transmission company. At the same time, fuel disruptions are worsening that situation, forcing grocery stores, gas stations, and other businesses to close because there is no diesel for generators. Many Puerto Ricans are questioning why it's taking so long to restore the power, since Fiona was a Category 1 storm that did not affect the entire island, and whose rain inflicted the greatest damage, not the wind. And U.S. stocks closed sharply lower on Friday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average ending at its lowest closing value since November of 2020, all three major benchmarks suffering another week of losses as bond yields rose in the wake of the Federal Reserve's interest rate hike on Wednesday. 6:32, WMAL traffic this morning with Angela Foster.
Traffic delays increasing on Interstate 66. Confirmation, not construction, but an accident. Westbound 66, just after 29 Gainesville. We're seeing backed up delays into Centerville as your middle lane is going to be blocked. Right center lane closed for westbound travel on Interstate 66. Watch for the backed up delays. We're seeing congestion all the way from the area of the Beltway, so there still may be some construction, and of course, we'll keep you up to speed. Meanwhile, as we take a look around the Capitol Beltway, moving well, no early distractions on our major thoroughfares. 270 moving nicely, despite the fact that we had some early construction and accident activity. Be alert for jam delays also for those traveling near the Cabin John Parkway, a crash eastbound on the Claire Barton Parkway. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Storm Watch 7 forecast.
A brisk start to the first weekend of fall. Temperatures will be climbing into the low and middle 70s this afternoon. A little bit less wind than we had yesterday under a good deal of sunshine. Overnight back in the 50s, some 40s in the cooler burbs. As we head through your Sunday, some added clouds on our next frontal system. Temperatures near 80 and maybe a shower or even an isolated rumble of thunder. By Monday, back to partly sunny skies and temperatures once again in the mid and upper 70s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Brian Vandegraaff in the First Alert Weather Center.
49 degrees now in the nation's capital, 6:34 on the Saturday morning update.
News Talk 105.9.
WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
It is a Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. Thank you for being with us. Jennifer Harper joins us, and she writes Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
Bill Maher makes some interesting comments, and you know, typically people view him as a liberal, but he can say some pretty reasonable things at times. And what's he saying this week?
Yeah, that's a very good way to put it. I mean, a lot of people think he may have some conservative leanings. And maybe they're right here, because he gave our HBO host, Bill Maher, if you're wondering who we're talking about, he gave an interview with Variety. And, of course, Varieties have been around forever, and they're just the organization of record when it comes to showbiz and all that kind of stuff. And this is a question that they asked Bill Maher this week. They said, what do you view as the Democrats' biggest problem heading into 2024? And here's what he said. The biggest problem with the Democrats is their woke baggage, he goes on to say. I think the Democrats could easily win every election if they didn't do the kind of things that make people go, oh, my God, this is the party of no common sense. He says, stop talking about pregnant men and stuff that makes people go, who are these people? What are they talking about? And Mr. Maher also went on to say, men don't get pregnant. And then he gave a little insight about Donald Trump, which was sort of interesting as well. And he says that he believes that former President Donald Trump is going to run again. He said, I'm certainly very concerned about that. I said that from the very beginning, that he's going to run again. There's no doubt. He hasn't conceded the last election. He's going to run again. That's coming from Bill Maher, and we'll just have to see about that.
Well, Friday was not friendly to the stock market, down another 486 points at the close. Moving forward, what does all of this mean when people go to the grocery store? You take the stock market tanking on top of the inflation.
Oh, my gosh, yes, and everyone's afraid to look at their 401k and everything else. But, yes, all of this kind of stuff is affecting people's basic behaviors when they're going through their busy days. And yes, of course, I have a poll. It's an interesting one, though. It's from Investors Business Daily. And they were asking people, you know, when you go to buy your groceries, what do you do? And here's what they said. 54% of Americans are buying store brands more often to deal with higher food costs. 48% are cutting down on all the high-ticket items like meat. 40% are shopping at bargain stores, like dollar stores, buying food there, or packaged goods anyway. 33% are eating smaller portions at meals. 23% are relying on food banks to supplement their groceries. 22% are receiving federal or state assistance. 21% are now skipping meals. 15% say they're growing vegetables. 11% say that higher prices have not had any impact on their expenses or behaviors. Again, that's only 11%. And 2% are not sure whether these prices have affected them or not. So it's an interesting cross-section of behaviors, because I find myself, you know, I'm looking for the bargains as well. But anyway, this is what Investors Business Daily is confirming for us.
I look at the headlines on my phone. I look at the headlines on my laptop. Of course, I listen to the radio, watch a little television. The headlines seem to be getting crazier every week. And this week, they all went nuclear, didn't they?
Oh, my gosh. Yes, it was Russian President Putin's turn to, you know, come out with the big headlines. And they were out there this week, about midweek. He said on Wednesday that he might resort to nuclear weapons if the situation with the Ukraine gets dire or doesn't solve itself or anything. So, you know, people got very nervous about that. And, of course, it gave the media something to do. And this was in a 24-hour period. I studied the headlines that came out of that announcement from Russia. And here's just a couple of them. Putin just doubled down on his nuclear threat. What that means, that came from Forbes. Putin flirts again with a grim prospect of nuclear war. This time he might mean it. That came from The Guardian. Biden condemns Putin's irresponsible nuclear threats. That's the Washington Post. Putin escalates Ukraine war, issues nuclear threat to the West. That came from Reuters. If a nuclear attack hits New York, these fallout shelters won't protect you. That came from the Gothamist, which is a local news organization. And, you know, we went through this only 2 weeks ago when there was another Russian official issued a stark nuclear warning to the United States. It was referred to as the chess game of death by Newsweek. And but this has been going on for a while, all the way back in March. Again, Putin's nuclear threats are a wake-up call to the world. That came from The Atlantic. And let's not forget this. Also came from The Atlantic on December 14th, 2021. So we're used to hearing it, but it's always weird when the press goes nuclear over what's coming out of Russia.
Animal rights activists and the Air and Space Museum. Help me out here.
Yeah, well, why not? It's a dull news week, perhaps, or maybe not. But anyway, let's go back to our friend Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon and so forth and so on. Well, a lot of people may not know that he just donated $200 million to the Smithsonian. Isn't that great? Well, $130 million of this amount is going to be used to develop the Bezos Learning Center at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. And they've already got five design proposals that are under consideration. But they're also, Rick, getting some very eagle-eyed scrutiny from a very high-profile animal rights group. That would be People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. That's PETA. And they have a big suggestion for the final design. And this is what they advised Jeff Bezos and the Smithsonian. They said, PETA just sent a letter to museum director Christopher Brown urging him to require the winning design firm to employ a bird-friendly design and use non-reflective glass so as to not contribute to the loss of the birds' lives. They went on to say that buildings kill up to a billion birds every year in the United States. The reflective surfaces depicted in the design proposals would lead to a disturbing and insupportable uptick in deaths, especially because Washington is situated along a major migratory route. And they also make the big point that given that many of the engineering marvels at the National Air and Space Museum were inspired by birds' flight, it's vital that the museum award a design that lets birds safely share the sky. And I was going to get, oh, well, but then I went, oh, yeah, well, you know, I can understand how they feel. The birds, you know, they're a part of the National Air and Space Museum as well, I guess.
Yeah, that migratory route is I-95. Jennifer Harper, inside the Beltway at the Washington Times, as always, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Rick. Have a good weekend, everybody.
6:43, the Saturday morning update on WMAL. Jim Trusty next. Right now, Angela Foster's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
Slow traffic on Interstate 66 now with another collision. We've been dealing with a crash on 66 westbound. For those traveling near the Fair Oaks area, we've got a second collision. So if you're traveling on 66, leaving the Capitol Beltway, already seeing some backup delays, a suspicious, likely a construction zone near 123. Now a second collision, the first crash, blocking your center lane after U.S. 29 in Gainesville. Keep in mind, if you travel 66, some midday construction will be happening. As you head toward 50 Fair Oaks, you'll have lane divides and some ramp closures will keep you up to speed. Otherwise, traffic moving pretty nicely around the region. Clara Barton Parkway, eastbound at the Cabin John Parkway. We did have an earlier accident that has been pushed out of the roadway to the shoulder. You may see some brief delays. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Storm Watch 7 forecast.
A brisk start to the first weekend of fall. Temperatures will be climbing into the low and middle 70s this afternoon. A little bit less wind than we had yesterday under a good deal of sunshine. Overnight back in the 50s, some 40s in the cooler burbs. As we head through your Sunday, some added clouds in our next frontal system. Temperatures near 80 and maybe a shower or even an isolated rumble of thunder. By Monday, back to partly sunny skies and temperatures once again in the mid and upper 70s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Brian Vandegraaff in the First Alert Weather Center.
49 degrees now in the nation's capital. 6:44, the Saturday morning update on WMAL. It is the Saturday morning update, our first weekend of fall, and we are joined by Jim Trusty. He is a member of the Trump legal team, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington, and he is the former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, thanks for making the time to be with us this morning.
Sure, happy to join you.
We've seen the media reports this week on the developments in the DOJ investigation of the documents seized from former President Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate, and we've been looking forward to getting your perspective on it. Walk us through what happened this week.
Sure. Well, we're racking up some frequent flyer miles because we have a Florida search warrant with a Washington, D.C. investigation that led us to a Brooklyn courtroom this week. And it's a function of the fact that the Florida judge appointed Judge Deary, or retired District Court Judge Deary, to be the special master presiding over some of these thorny issues that relate to the search warrant executed at Mar-a-Lago. So the judge ordered the parties on fairly short notice to come up to Brooklyn and have a status conference on Tuesday. And the sad reality is that status conferences are not the most substantive, exciting things for the general public, so I won't bore the listener here with the vivid details of talking about deadlines and data vendors and some of the things that came up. But it was a fairly interesting kind of give and take. The judge is a feisty guy and one that certainly knows his way around the courthouse, and he put the parties to the test. He'd ask pretty pointed questions. And we went through it and ended up with at least a working idea of what this fairly unusual process was going to look like when it came to allowing the president's lawyers to inspect thousands of documents that were seized from Mar-a-Lago. So we're hashing out the timing of that and some of the parameters, and there's already been some give and take between the parties and the special master, Judge Deary, about that. One thing that I think was kind of interesting, Rick, is the judge set up a call-in number for the media. We certainly had plenty of media there in the court, but he set up a call-in number, and literally right when the hearing began, we heard a loud disconnect, and we lost all the folks that had called in to listen in. But it didn't stop the commentators. I was told about a report on a network not known for loving President Trump that announced that we couldn't listen to the hearing and we didn't have anybody there, but we're now going to talk about how Trump's lawyers lost today, which seems to be par for the course, but I guess it comes with the territory. So it was productive. It might be the only time we end up in Brooklyn. Judge Deary seems like he's going to shift to a lot more kind of telephonic contact to monitor how this thing plays out, and eventually some other hearings, but it's not 100% clear where they will be. But I can tell you, Brooklyn was actually beautiful that day. It was a great day, and it was kind of interesting to get into a courthouse I hadn't been to before, and you know, maybe we'll be back later in the fall, maybe we won't.
You mentioned the media, and there was a story in one of the political publications about a humorous moment between one of the Trump attorneys and the media in the courtroom. And I said to myself, that sounds like Jim.
Yeah, I don't really want to dime out anybody who may have participated in that, but it was somebody named Jim Trusty. Anyway, the layout of the courtroom was kind of unusual. You know, in the old days, Rick, you'd have the prosecution on the right and the defense on the left, and everybody's facing the judge, and maybe the jury is on one side or the other. It was always a pretty rigid layout. Something has happened to courthouses across America over the last couple of decades where they have some sort of bizarre egalitarian impulse where nobody can make sense of where you're supposed to sit. And in fact, the tables in this courtroom, and I've seen this a lot, are actually like perpendicular to the judge and stacked next to each other. So we were the plaintiffs, which meant we sat on the table to the right. We'd have to turn our neck about 90 degrees to address the judge from where we sat. We had the good fortune to be sitting at the table closest to the jury box. And what Judge Deary did for this particular hearing is he obviously allowed the media to come into the courtroom in general, but the first 12 were allowed to go fill the jury box. So I'm sitting at a table that's probably all of 8 feet away from 10 media member jurors and two sketch artist jurors. And they were all sitting there, and, you know, they've got their job to do, I understand. I'm not particularly hostile on any personal level to members of the media. But when the judge's clerk came in, I thought I'd have some fun. So I walked over to the clerk in a very conspicuously loud voice. I said, you know, can you please tell the judge I've never seen such an unfair jury and I'd like to strike all 12 from this trial? The problem is, Rick, I had a mask on. They're still worried about COVID in New York. So I think, you know, the jury was kind of split. I think about six jurors got it and not jurors, but media members, got it and kind of laughed. And the other six glared at me like, how dare you assault us like this, not realizing I was smiling underneath my mask. So I saw a couple of little reports that talked about it. And, I mean, this goes to show, I guess, two things. One is that I'm hopelessly immature. But secondly, that, you know, even in high-stakes matters, there's nothing wrong with having a little bit of fun when you're kind of killing the time. And lots of lawyers and lots of people associated with the criminal justice system, even in very serious proceedings, recognize that, you know, we're all human. There's nothing wrong with having a little bit of fun if you can.
What is scheduled in the weeks ahead?
Well, there's a lot of deadlines that are scheduled, but they're kind of internal things that really won't play out publicly. It's not about court appearances. It's really about sifting through the materials that were taken from Mar-a-Lago. So we're reviewing materials, we're meeting the deadlines that the special master has imposed, and we're essentially narrowing down issues for the special master to help Judge Cannon in Florida resolve. So there'll be an awful lot of stuff below the surface. People watching from the outside will just see the duck. They won't see the feet paddling underneath. But the parties will be real busy. But we won't really return to court, at least for several weeks, most likely.
I know our audience has really enjoyed our conversations about various cases in the news. And there was one we talked about probably been over a year or so now. And it involves a judge in Newton, Massachusetts, who was charged by the U.S. Attorney's Office for helping a twice-deported illegal immigrant evade federal immigration officials in 2018. That was 4 years ago. There was a development in the case this week. Refresh us on what happened in 2018 and then what happened this week.
Yeah, and we have talked about this at least once or twice. This is a judge named Shelley Joseph from Newton, Massachusetts, and she had a court officer, like her kind of right-hand deputy, named Wesley McGregor. They were charged federally by the U.S. attorney at the time with conspiring and allowing a wanted defendant to avoid ICE authorities who were waiting at the courthouse to detain him for once again illegally reentering the United States. The specific facts were pretty outrageous, and it was that the judge knew that ICE was there to take him into custody and presumably remove him once again from the United States. She instructed her court officer to go tell the ICE agent to wait in a particular hallway, saying this is where we always let the state defendants go at the end of the hearing. So the ICE agent followed her instructions, took a seat, sat there waiting and waiting and waiting until he realized something was wrong. And what was wrong was the court officer used his swipe key, all of this with the judge's apparent blessing, to let the defendant out a back door and sneak away from the ICE authorities, who the judge had effectively occupied and duped into waiting in the wrong place. So the case went federal with the U.S. attorney at the time, a President Trump appointee, charging her with various serious offenses, obstruction, harboring a fugitive, things of that nature. And then there was a series, and the reason why this dropped off the map for so long, a series of interlocutory appeals. You know, an interlocutory appeal means it's not after a verdict or a finding of guilt. It's earlier in the case. So they're kind of unusual. You don't usually have a whole lot of appeals before the ultimate merits are decided. And it went up the chain in federal court, and eventually the battle being over whether the judge was somehow immune from prosecution, well, the prosecutors won. So the case finally came back and was set for trial. And now we have a different boss at the U.S. Attorney's Office. It was a new U.S. attorney appointed by President Biden who was recused. The new U.S. attorney said that she wouldn't be able to be on this particular case for some pre-existing relationship with the state judge. And so the U.S. attorney for Rhode Island, appointed again by Joe Biden, came in to handle the case as a favor on a recusal. And what happened this week is something that's actually very rare in federal court, which is a non-pros agreement, a non-prosecution agreement. As a defense attorney, you love the idea of a non-prosecution agreement because it means federal authorities, no matter how much they built up a case, how much time they invested, they're willing to walk away without any sort of conviction. Usually there's a condition. You know, the person has to do something to earn or to satisfy the non-prosecution agreement. Here, the only condition that was put on the judge to get a total dismissal of these charges is that she will self-report to the state judicial ethics committee sometime in the next month and say, hey, I did something that might have been wrong. What do you think? I can tell you, I think the odds of her getting disbarred are maybe about the same as a lightning strike while you're being attacked by a shark on land. I do not think she's going to have any sort of consequence. She never missed a paycheck during this entire process. And so, again, you know, I hesitate, partly as a defense attorney, to ever criticize the notion that prosecutors have discretion and that they can temper justice with mercy from time to time. But man, oh man, Rick, this smells like the two-tiered system we keep talking about, you know, that this is a person who broke federal law blatantly, knows that she did, I mean, was caught red-handed when the whole story came out, and gets the benefit of being the favored class. And so we have this rare non-prosecution agreement being imposed for a judge who did the kind of thing that people on the left side of the aisle tend to favor, which is breaking any rule ends justifying the means when it comes to doing something like protecting, in this case, a third-time illegal reenter state criminal in Massachusetts. So, again, I think frustrating story for those of us who just want to have equal justice, not politicized justice.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington, thank you very much for the update. We look forward to talking to you next weekend.
Sounds good. Have a great weekend.
And you too. 6:57. This is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. We will talk with K.T. McFarland, also John Gizzi, White House correspondent at Newsmax. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer is on the way, and also Cheryl Atkinson, host of Full Measure.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9. WMAL.